Ezekiel's prophecy came from captivity to those who would be joining him. Like Jeremiah, Ezekiel was from the priestly line. And like Jeremiah, who was Ezekiel's contemporary, Ezekiel received a call from the Lord to be a prophet, a call that indicated that his ministry would have no evident converts, that no one would listen, or that if they listened, they would not act upon what they heard. Jeremiah delivered the message of certain calamity in Jerusalem among those who remained after the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar on two prior occasions, first in 605 B.C., and then 8 years later in 597 B.C., took people from Judah captive to Babylon. Now, if you had been among those who were left in Jerusalem, you might have thought that somehow you had managed to stay and that you would elude any additional difficulties in Jerusalem. Well, if you had been of that mind, Ezekiel's message, both to those already in captivity and to those who were still in Jerusalem, was that they should not delude themselves that somehow the kingdom would survive. In fact, the message of Ezekiel was, if such a thing were possible, even darker and more foreboding than the straightforward predictions from Jeremiah in Jerusalem. Jeremiah simply said, the kingdom's going to fall. We have read in this passage about the grievous sin of the land against God and his law. The overtone was unmistakable. The previous reversals, by that I mean the taking of people captive away from Jerusalem, those reversals did not have the effect of turning the people back to the Lord. That did not happen. It didn't happen on the throne. It did not happen to anyone else. In fact, the situation was quite the opposite. The people doubled down, to use a modern expression, as it were, in their determination to have things their own way. In Jerusalem, when people heard Jeremiah's warnings, they suggested that he was a traitor who should at the very least be imprisoned, if not executed. In Babylon, where Ezekiel was called to exercise his ministry brought similar scorn from the captives, who you would have thought would have learned something through their painful experience. But the Lord makes it plain in this passage that the end game was underway. The last descendant of King David to occupy the throne at Jerusalem was Zedekiah. Sometimes he's referred to by another name, by Coniah, but he was Zedekiah. And his unhappy reign, he reigned for the last 11 years of the kingdom's history, his unhappy reign would collapse eventually under the pressure of a siege by the Chaldean army that lasted 2 years. So for 2 years, the only people who went in and out of Jerusalem did so with the permission of the Chaldean army. In those dreadful circumstances, there was nothing that could avert the catastrophe of which Jeremiah warned. Yet, speaking for the Lord, the prophet Ezekiel in this passage suggested that there could be still, even in such awful conditions, as many as three men of the stature of Noah, Daniel, and Job in the land. It's a striking thing. I've thought about this a lot. It's a striking thing that they should appear together in this passage, because they certainly were not contemporaries. But here the Holy Spirit puts them together in this passage and suggests that if it were possible to have those three men all together in the land at this time, such a conjunction of spiritual giants, you would think, could do something to halt the advance of disaster. Because each of those men lived in days that were difficult for the people of God. They lived in days when their testimonies appeared to bear at least a little fruit. Still, they're mentioned here in this way, being drawn together. And this is the only place in the Bible where you find these three names drawn together. Their mention here is an indication that those men who were faithful in their own times, in difficult days, would only be able to save themselves in the day of which we are reading here. They do inspire us by their example to continue letting our light so shine before men that they may see our good works, as Jesus said, and glorify our Father which is in heaven. Those three men from vastly different periods in history were shining lights in dark times. Shining lights in dark times. I want you to think upon that theme with me this evening. Now, the implication of the passage we have read is quite clear, that each of these men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, had a deserved reputation as a prayer warrior, as an intercessor. And they established that reputation in days when it must have seemed that efforts at intercession were futile. This passage instructs us that intercession then, in the time in which Ezekiel was prophesying, intercession had distinct limits in that time, because God's purpose was to bring judgment, and there was no way it was going to be averted. And yet, you think about those men in their times, and we'll consider their times in just a moment, but those men had to believe in their times, individually in history, that it was not a vain exercise to seek the Lord in behalf of those, in each case, who were perched on the edge of oblivion. But God said that in this time they could do nothing but to deliver their own souls in the face of such potent judgment. And yet in their own times, to some extent, they had some impact on those nearest to them. Noah saw the salvation of his family, 8 souls saved in the ark. Daniel labored to see his friends delivered from the schemes of those in Babylon who hated them. Job interceded for his 3 friends that they would be spared from divine judgment on their folly. But the message of Ezekiel is if those men had been living in the kingdom of Judah at the time of Ezekiel, they would not have been able to save anyone but themselves. That's how dark the times were. And that's a solemn realization. But in their own times, though their times were very dark, they still continued. Their lights kept shining in each case to the moment of divine visitation. I want you to think about three aspects corresponding to these three men of our theme this evening. First, warning of the approaching devastation. Warning of the approaching devastation. And here we deal with Noah. Noah was a preacher of righteousness. We read of him that he found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Not that he found grace because he was a preacher of righteousness, but that he was a preacher of righteousness because he found grace in the eyes of the Lord. He was a man of faith in a world that was plunging rapidly toward disaster. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6. The first part of the chapter, which we're not going to read out loud here, deals with the limitation that God places on the inhabitation of the earth before the flood by the people whom he made. The Lord said that it repented him that he had made man on the earth. He was going to destroy all of them. But we read in verse 8, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. And Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now pay attention to verse 11. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. The root of this violence we find in verse 5 of the chapter. God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. These descendants of Adam filled the earth with violence. So in verse 14, you begin with the instruction to Noah, make an ark. And you find the details of that construction there. It was to be a massive vessel. And in verse 17, you read the warning. Behold, I, even I, do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, wherein is the breath of life from under heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. But with thee will I establish my covenant. And thou shalt come into the ark, thou and thy sons and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee. And he goes on to give further instruction about saving the land animals in the ark. And we read in verse 22, thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded him, so did he. So he was told to build the ark. He was a righteous man, strictly by the grace of God. He found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And his faith, which manifested itself in obedience was the result of God's grace in his life. I want you to see that. It wasn't that Noah was a superman. Noah was just a man whom God purposed to use. If we turn to Hebrews chapter 11, the famous chapter that deals with the subject of faith, we find in verse 7 these words regarding Noah. By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, that's critical, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. So what we find there in that verse is that he was warned about things that had never happened. And he moved with fear, not terror as to that which was promised, but the fear of God, that what God said was going to come to pass. He was a man of faith. He prepared an ark to the saving of the house. And notice that the preparation of the ark, we read in verse 7, was itself a condemnation of the world around him. No one had seen anything like what Noah warned was going to come. Noah started telling people, God's going to bring a great flood. I'm building an ark so that those who want to be saved from the destruction can find shelter in the ark. And they found it impossible to believe. It had never happened. No one had ever seen anything like what Noah was describing, and they believed that Noah was really not in his right mind to believe that such a thing could ever come. Now, I've thought a lot about Noah over the years and thought about him going through this laborious process. This was a major undertaking. They did not have modern building materials and techniques available, but it was a major undertaking. And for all those years when they were working on it, to keep on doing that work and to keep on preaching about the coming judgment, warning people about it, warning people, God is bringing a flood. Turn from your sins now while you can. Believe the message of the Lord now. Find salvation now in the ark. Noah, of course, was the grandson of Methuselah. And he knew the significance of his grandfather's name. Literally, in the Hebrew, when he dies, it shall come. What was it? That was the judgment. That was the name that Enoch gave to Methuselah. Now, Methuselah lived longer than any other person in history. Lacked just 31 years of living 1,000 years. But Noah knew that however long Methuselah lived, when he would die, the time for the flood was at hand. And surely enough, if you go and figure it out, you can work it out through the chronologies in the scriptures, you will find that in the very year in which Methuselah died, the flood came to the world. And the day came. If you went on to read in Genesis 7, the day came when the cargo that the ark was to carry was safely inside. Only eight people. Maybe 1.5 billion or more were living in the world at that time, but only eight people were in the ark. Others could have joined, but they did not. The animals that Noah was commanded to put into the ark were in the ark. And we read that God shut the door. And at that time, there was no longer any hope for the people outside the ark. 7 days later, all the refusal to believe Noah vanished in the overwhelming cataclysm, and it did not take long. The scriptures tell us the windows of the heavens were open, the fountains of the great deep were broken up, vast reservoirs of subterranean water in the seas were broken up, and tremendous geysers gushed miles and miles and miles into the atmosphere. And that water crashed down upon the earth and created tremendous tidal waves that within a short time overwhelmed all the dry land. In that time, Noah's intercession delivered his family. But Ezekiel says, if he were living in the time of Ezekiel, Noah's intercession would have availed only for himself. That tells you how dark the times were. Now we come to consider the next man of whom we read here, Daniel. Working under an astonishing declaration. Working under an astonishing declaration. Now, it is quite possible that Ezekiel and Daniel knew each other. They would have been alive in the same time. Daniel, of course, was taken into the government. Ezekiel was not, so that could have been a barrier to their knowing each other. But Daniel and his three young friends, of whom we read in Daniel 1, were certainly known to Ezekiel. It was Daniel's calling as a young man, when he was taken into captivity, to serve the Lord faithfully. And it was not an easy task. There was a concerted campaign against him by people in the government who despised him and his stand for the truth. And they despised him also because he was not a corrupt individual like so many others. His friends, of course, felt the impact of Nebuchadnezzar's decree, of which we read in Daniel chapter 3, that no one should worship any but him, or the image of him that he had caused to be set up. And you know the story, these three young men, I like to refer to them by their Hebrew names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Thanks to some Sunday school songs, they tend to be known more by their Chaldean names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Always found it interesting that Daniel's name is very familiar. His Chaldean name is not so commonly known, Belteshazzar. But these three are known by their Chaldean names. But these three young men refused to bow down to the golden image. That is, they just stayed as they were. They were standing when the music played. Everybody else bowed down to worship the golden image. They did not. Suddenly, they were very conspicuous simply because they kept standing. It's funny how that happens. When you keep standing for the truth, then suddenly you become the target. What is wrong with them? Why are they standing? And of course, they were brought before the king and charged with failing to worship, and they refused to worship, so they were cast into the fiery furnace. As a result, God delivered them, we read in the scriptures, And I am very certain that Daniel was praying for them during that experience, praying for their deliverance. They said to the king, "Whatever you do, be it known unto you, we will not worship that image." Later, of course, long after Nebuchadnezzar was gone from the scene, and long after the Babylonian Empire had collapsed, Daniel faced the same kind of declaration. We find that in the book of Daniel chapter 6. The book of Daniel chapter 6. The first verses of the chapter tell us of the way in which Daniel was the most prominent of all the people in the kingdom except the king. We read in verse 4, "Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could find none occasion nor fault. For as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Then said these men, 'We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God.' Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him, 'King Darius, live forever.'" Of course, they knew that he wasn't going to live forever, but that is what they said. "All the presidents of the kingdom," in verse 7, "the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not." And Darius said, "Well, that sounds perfectly reasonable." So in verse 9, he signed the writing and the decree. So here is this astonishing declaration. Daniel is now an old man, spent his whole life really in captivity. He's an old man now, but he established a testimony of being faithful to his God. And we read in verse 10, "When Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God." And we read in verse 12, "Then they came to the king and they said, 'Daniel, you know, the one who's such a prominent leader in your administration, O king, he's violating the law.'" And the king, of course, in verse 14, was very displeased. He never thought about how this law would affect somebody like Daniel. He tried to save Daniel from the punishment. But those men said, "You know, you have to obey the law." So they put Daniel into the lion's den. And you know the rest of the story, of course. God sent his angel and shut the mouths of the lions, and eventually all those men who were against Daniel ended up being devoured by the lions. But the thing that is striking is that Daniel was in the face of the severest possible pressure. "Daniel, you must conform. Daniel, you must bend." So he knew what pressure was. But Ezekiel's word in this passage is that if Daniel had been living in Jerusalem with Noah and Job at this time, he could not have saved the kingdom of Judah. His intercession, as valuable as it was, would not have saved any but himself. But in Daniel's day, as in Noah's day, He kept on, though the times were very dark. And that brings me to the third man mentioned here, to Job. And concerning Job, we observe witnessing in abasing desolation. Witnessing in abasing desolation. He was in a very desperate condition. We considered, of course, something of Job's story last week in the first chapter of Job. Talked about Satan's secret war against the saints. So I'm not going to go over that ground again. But we may say that Job, in spite of all the problems that he encountered, whose cause he never really did find out, refused to turn upon the Lord. He refused to condemn the Lord or to abandon his cause. It's true that he may not have understood and was reasoning in his mind about it. But never once do we find any condemnation of the Lord. This Job, after he came through this awful experience, demonstrated the power of grace in his life. Let us turn to the book of Job into chapter 42. Last week we considered the first chapter. Now we're going to read from the last chapter of the book of Job. Job chapter 42. And verse 7. Job has said in verse 6, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Verse 7, and it was so, that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Job hath. Therefore take unto you now 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, in that ye have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite went and did according as the Lord commanded them. The Lord also accepted Job. And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. So here was Job, having been through this awful experience, part of which was made even worse by the words of these three men. And Job interceded for them, that God's anger should be turned away from them. So this faithful witness of which we read here from Job must be most impressive to us, because Job suffered greatly personally. He suffered severe grief, the loss of his family, the loss of his business. He suffered physical and emotional anguish through attacks on his own body. But in his testimony, he remained steadfast when his wife said to him, it's just enough now, God's abandoned you, why don't you curse God and die? He said to her, you talk like the foolish women talk. His testimony always was, I didn't come into this world with anything and I'm not going out with anything. So whatever God does with me is right and just. Remaining steadfast in his testimony. He delivered those three men from the judgment of God upon them. But here in this context, in Ezekiel, the Lord said, if Job were in Jerusalem at this time, he could not have prevailed to save anyone else but himself. So there you have these three men. Now notice that the scripture is not saying, the prophet is not saying that these three men were actually there together. That's not the point. We want to be sure we don't miss that conditional statement, though these three men were in it. If it were possible, in grammar that is called the subjunctive mood, if it were possible for these three men, as great as intercessors as they were, if it were possible for them to be in the land, in Jerusalem, they could not deliver anyone but themselves. And that tells you how dark the times were. But it also tells you this, they would still be engaged in that intercession. They would still be seeking the deliverance of souls. Now look, we live in dark times. But God's people have always lived in dark times. I don't want you to be under any delusion about that. We have a tendency to look back at the past, and because we don't actually live in the past, that is, we don't occupy that context in the past, we tend to gloss over a lot of things. But God's people have always lived in dark times. The apostles warned it would be so. We live in dark times. And we do not know who we may deliver by our intercession. But the call is there to be faithful in our testimony, and to seek, as we read in James, to snatch some out of the burning, to snatch some as brands out of the fire. The Lord said these three men, who were great prayer warriors, gave themselves to intercession. And yet the Lord said they could not have saved the kingdom from final disaster. So it's a solemn thing for us to consider in our own times that there comes a day of limit when God said that is the end. There will be no more mercy. The door of the ark was closed. And after that, the people who were outside were without hope. And within a week, they were all dead. There is a powerful lesson then for us to continue faithful in our own witness, to be steadfast in our testimony, and to seek in whatever way God puts at our disposal to pray that others will be delivered. But we do so recognizing that the day of judgment is approaching. And we recognize that God is perfectly within his right to do as he wills and to bring to pass his sentence upon those who continue in their rebellion against him. Let us then observe the example of these men as shining lights in dark times. Let us shine in these dark times that people may understand that we serve one who has called us out of darkness and into his marvelous light.